Ladies and gentlemen, what's going on? This is the QTR Podcast. Today is April 19th, 2019. Right up front, I do want to thank my patrons for making this podcast possible. My Patreons are people that donate a monthly recurring sum to help support the podcast. They are the capitalistic engine behind the podcast. And first and foremost, I want to shout out some of the people that make the QTR Podcast happen. First are my friends over at Quantamize, Quantamize, quantamize.com. They have been ranked the number one alternative to a Bloomberg terminal, and as of right now, ladies and gentlemen, their entire service is free. You can get a link to Quantamize in the podcast description. You can go check them out for free. They give you access to over 10,000 stocks, options, and cryptos, all different types of strategies. You have nothing to lose by checking out Quantamize. I also want to shout out my friends over at RumorHound. RumorHound is an awesome, innovative new tool that allows you to sort through all of the rumors that come through on a daily basis, specifically those dealing with mergers and acquisitions. Feels like every day somebody is on a chat room or somebody is on Twitter and they have chatter or they have rumors about potential M&A acquisitions. It's very difficult to sort through all of that and try to figure out which are coming from credible sources, which are ones that maybe you should pay more attention to than others. And that's what the people over at RumorHound are trying to help you with. Just on a personal note, if you're a trader, if you're an active trader, especially if you're somebody in the options market, you're somebody that follows options flow, RumorHound feels like a product that could supplement and really help out somebody who's into day trading, especially because, again, when you're dealing with rumors and you're dealing with stocks that are moving quickly on rumors, perception, things that are confirmed, unconfirmed, and you need pretty much all the help you can get to try and get in front of what could potentially be legitimate chatter for a legitimate transaction, RumorHound's going to help you try to figure that out. So there is a link to them in the podcast description as well. I also want to thank my friends over at Hella Bacon. Hella Bacon, group of guys in Texas, they're shooting machine guns out of helicopters, folks, and they would love to take you up and give you a whirl at it if it's something that you're interested in. Certainly, if I'm ever in Texas, I'm going to look up Hella Bacon. You can check them out. They also have a link in my podcast description. Talk about things to put on your fucking bucket list, right? Finally, I want to shout out my friends over at Corvus Gold, my friends at Investors Underground, my friend Chris Bede, Ken R., Chris Boas, and Russ Valenti. Piggly Wiggly, Nathan Weiss, Mike, Chris Sharkey, and Matt Merle, you guys help make the podcast a reality through your generous and consistent contributions. I also want to shout out a couple of my newest patrons, my friends like TJ, Nate Lowell, Rand Cannon, Paul Brennan, Kyle Thomas, Carter Bell, my friend Sugar Bear, my friend Post Plastic Surgery Balance Sheet. I don't even know what that means, but stoked to have you on board. I want to thank Aubergine, Randy Goon, Morgan McGarren, Shvetty McDangley, Balsack, Von Kavich, Steindlofshofen. Still can't say that one, but whatever. Ryan Chapman, Rock That Frog, my friend Art Spurl, my buddy Justin, and then some of my older patrons that have been with me, people like Bertha Moreno, people like Jack and Jesse Stroik, Lyle Engel, Ned DeLorme, Kinman Tom, Marco Vitti, Greg Kroll. Really appreciate you guys. Of course, I haven't forgotten about Interstellar Ginger Beer, Flo Algo, or my friends Elon's Doobie, Metal Alpha, Benjamin White, Vertical Spread Options Trading. I really appreciate you guys. Space Ventures, and Space Ventures Investors, and Don Kelly, Tommy B. Jack Burton's been down for a while. James Tombor's been down since last October. I appreciate you guys very much. Before we get started with what's definitely going to be a kick-ass interview, two more things. The first is I am not a financial advisor, folks. It's very simple. And you see me put up a little hashtag DYRE? That means do your fucking research elsewhere. I left the F out, but if you get a DYFRE, it means do your fucking research elsewhere, folks. I'm not a financial advisor, and this is not financial advice. So whatever you do, don't listen to anything I or any guests on this podcast ever say, ever, including right now. Stop listening right now. Having said that, also, I recommend a two-drink minimum for this podcast. Given that it is Good Friday and that most of you guys are off work and it is already the afternoon, I imagine, call it a sixth sense, call it a seventh sense, call it an eighth sense, I imagine one or two of you may have already had a breakfast cocktail, a lunch cocktail. You guys are probably already where you need to be by the time that you listen to this podcast tonight. But just a reminder, I do recommend a two-drink minimum for this podcast. We like to keep it fast and loose. Thank you to the patrons. Thank you to the people listening. Let's get this motherfucking show on the road. I have somebody with me today that I am really looking forward to speaking to. This gentleman is, I'm going to describe him as an economic commentator. I don't know if that's part of his official bio, but I see him as an economic commentator. He is the Betty R. Miller Professor of Chemistry and Chemical Biology and the Chemistry Department Chair Professor at Cornell University. You can correct me if I'm wrong about any of that. I stole it off the internet. He holds a PhD from Columbia. He has a master's from Columbia and another master's from Columbia and a bachelor of science from Cornell. That sounds like a couple of community colleges, huh? I have David B. Collum with me today. How are you, sir?
I'm good. I'm no longer department chair. I shook that job and now I'm a civilian again.
Good for you. I found the I found your bio on the internet. I hope you don't mind that I didn't check over any of it with you before we got started.
Yeah, no, we're fine. We're good.
I play it fast and loose. So, Dave, listen, man, I found you on Twitter. This is a really interesting kind of thing that we're doing this podcast. You know, on one of Joe Rogan's old podcasts, he just says, like, the internet is a wonderful thing because it links you up with all these people that maybe you wouldn't have ever stumbled upon or talked to, you know, had it not have existed. And I feel like Twitter is the tie that binds us because we have been following each other on Twitter for a long time. And I find your commentary on the economy, I think we're very like-minded about a lot of things. So I was astonished to see that you were actually an organic chemistry professor and not somebody that worked in the field of finance or, you know, in the field of economics, at least to the best of my understanding. So I guess my first question to you, aside from hello, how are you, is how did you actually wind up becoming kind of a economic commentator as well as, your quote unquote day job as an organic chemist or a professor?
Well, you know, the connectivity of Twitter is amazing, and the people who I can connect with. You know, I don't know why people are on Twitter who just share baking recipes and stuff. That makes no sense to me. But for me, it gives access to people that I couldn't fathom contacting. It's like you mentioned Joe Rogan saying that it connects me up with Joe Rogan, right? And one of my dream podcasts would be on Joe's
right,
podcast,
yep.
which are just legendary, right? We'd all like that one. When I was a kid, my dad and I used to talk about this stuff, and then I went totally dormant until I would say the early 90s when I started to get old enough and wealthy enough that I started to worry about this stuff again. And one of my colleagues actually lit me up. It was kind of a funny story. I went out to lunch with this traveling salesman, right? Sounds like a penthouse ladder, but I go out with this traveling salesman who goes from pharma to pharma to pharma, and he takes everyone out to lunch and he would chat about stocks. And the more he did that, the more the CEOs of the company wanted to take him out. And so he became this conduit. And one day he took me out to lunch with my friend, and he was telling me about this little company called LDDS in Alabama, I think, or Mississippi. He says, you really ought to buy it. They're buying up bandwidth, right, and they're really going to get rich. And so I took a dormant IRA that had money that was a lot, but I wasn't doing anything with it, and I bought LDDS. And it turns out that turned into WorldCom. And so my first purchase as an investor, sort of without indexing, I racked up a 7-bagger on WorldCom and got the hell out. That's the
wow.
So, yeah, I know everyone else got eaten alive, and I got out for other reasons, but then I kind of got hooked, and I was a raging bull. And I was such a raging bull that I was just making a ton on tech stocks in the late 90s. I'm not a trader, but I bought a bunch. I bought Dell Bag 7 on that one. Some pharma stuff that he put me on. Warner Lambert, I made a fortune off his recommendation. I thought this guy was God. It was because he was shepherding information from person to person to person. And then I think around July, I started to get really nervous about the market. I guess I've been stumbling into some places saying, you know, this market's nuts. And dumped half my equities around the 1st of July, as I remember, in 98. And then it tanked right into the Asian crisis, right? And I thought, Jesus Christ, I'm either half smart or half stupid. I don't know which. And I swore I'd get out if they came back. And so by mid-99, I, actually had exited every last equity and decided, I was doing calculations on some of the stupid ones and saying, look, if they grow revenues 20% a year, earnings 20% a year, it'll take them 15 years to get to a credible valuation, right? And for reasons I can't remember, I got into gold. And so some really lucky stuff early, right? Making it in the techs and then getting the hell out and then making it in gold. So I was buying gold from 290 down to 270. And then I started to bleed, you know, the NASDAQ was still raging and I'm buying gold and I'm not fessing up to anybody, right? I'm telling no one because no one buys gold, right? No one buys gold. And finally, someone asks me, says, what are you doing? And I said, I'm buying gold. And he goes, gold? Really? I go, yeah, gold. He's the first guy I told. He just sold his company. And I said, don't buy these tech stocks. You're going to get hurt. And so in any event, so I rode through, and I was buying. I made a fortune on energy until it beat me up. But the gold served me well, even if you account for the tanking. I saw a chart the other day. You probably saw it where I posted it. That came out where J.P. Morgan posted a 20-year return. Happened to be from 1999.
I did see that.
And gold beat S&P by 2% a year compounded. So I kind of made a snarky-ass comment about how you young punks who've never seen an equity bear market, could you go up and read that what the second-place winner was? And my old tired eyes just aren't good enough to read that. What is that asset class up there again? And I got some pushback from people saying, well, you cherry-picked the date. I go, that's the date I bought it. That's the day I traded S&P for gold. That's not cherry-picking. So in any event, so I've been a bear throughout the last cycle. And that's been painful to watch, but I've never felt wrong about it. That's the irony is this most recent cycle from 09 up has felt completely fraudulent the whole way. And yeah, I wish I'd been in it, right? That would have been easy, right? I also wish I was, you know, married to a supermodel too. My wife better not listen to this one, but you can't look at it that way. And I really thought we were going to get beaten up pretty good beyond 09. And I just never saw the, you know, was it $14, $15 trillion worth of intervention that helped re-levitate the markets. I think the central bankers are a bunch of pinheads, but they made, you know, reckless people very wealthy.
Yeah, it's funny when you say earlier, you know, you're just talking about when you bought gold for the first time, how, you know, even when you went to tell somebody, you kind of had to, you know, kind of had to make it an aside or whisper it to him. It's just always been so fascinating to me. And I'm sorry, because I know we talked yesterday. You were like, let's talk about anything but gold. And here we are talking about gold immediately.
I know. Well, that's the history, right?
but it's always just been fascinating to me, like, why it's such a big fucking, like, faux pas, you know, to own gold. Why it is treated with such disdain and such, you know, it's just... The media and economists, you know, quote unquote economists and, you know, academic economists and, you know, these people, they look at an investment in gold. When you say I'm in gold to preserve wealth or I'm in gold as a hedge and you said, you know, who's buying it? Well, the fucking central banks are buying it, you know? And so, but should an individual investor go on television if you make an appearance on CNBC and you say what you said to me? Which is in 99 or whatever, you traded your equities for gold, you know, you're going to get laughed at despite the return, right? I mean, isn't that fascinating?
Yeah. The other thing is people say, well, pick another date. And so I actually, you know, yeah, I write this annual review. That's really what kind of put me on the map, actually. But last year, I think it was, I can't keep them straight anymore, but there's so many of them. But 1 year at least, I went back to 72, I think it was, when gold became legal. And I looked at the annual rate of return on gold from 72, and it's about 8% a year. And I go, you know, you can laugh at that all you want. You give me 8% a year from here. Oh my God, I'll mortgage the house and everything else. I'll go all in on an 8%. No one's going to get 8%. Maybe David Tepper is going to get 8%. But only guys with his kind of dexterity, you know, I don't think the Dalios or these other guys are supposedly legends. I don't think they're going to get it.
Yet if your goal is to preserve wealth and, right. you know, you measure the commodity in dollars, which we're printing an endless supply of, to me, it's just fascinating how obvious, you know, now forget about several thousand years of track record as an economic instrument, right? But think about any commodity that's measured in dollars, right? People just think, well, we're not really having inflation because it's made a stop here in asset prices, right?
But you won't get rich in gold. Here's the irony is I hate the gold equities. Those guys, you know, and guys I think are so smart, guys like James Grant, and I think Fleckenstein's got a good head on his shoulders. I know you've interviewed him. And they talk about how cheap the equities are, and all I can see are companies that have never made a buck. They can't, when gold was 1900, they weren't making any money. And I go, you know, until you prove to me you guys know how to mine gold for a profit, I am not interested in some optionality on gold. Now, you're not going to get rich on gold unless you become a market timer, because on average, it's just going to track inflation or something, right? And it's not going to track it. It's not going to track it rigorously. You know, the guys who say, oh, it tracks inflation, they're nuts in anything but long term. We'll get rich owning gold if gold, you know, takes a moonshot and you're smart enough to get out when you say, look, if I sell my gold, I can buy Intel for a PE of 7, right? Something like that. That'd be great. So when I can buy something better, when I can buy something cheap, maybe I'll liquidate my gold and do it. But I got a ton of cash too, so I'm going to mow through a lot of cash before I have to start selling gold.
Assuming that whatever causes the spike in gold price that you're talking about, that you would sell off on to buy Intel at a PE of 7, hasn't fucked the system so royally that
then you hang out of the gold. Yeah.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah, but I'm going to look lousy in a purple mohawk too, so I'm already toasted if we get to that Road Warrior stage.
One of the things that I wanted to ask you was, you know, you just told me now, look, you're not interested in mining companies, which is really a contrast with what, you know, Fleckenstein and Peter Schiff said the same thing to me, which was, you know, where you're really going to make a multiple, where you're going to make a premium on the spot price of gold is in owning the mining company. So it's interesting to hear you disagree with that. My question to
you might. No, I don't disagree with it. I'm just not interested because the gold went from 256 to 1900, the mining companies soared, and then they gave it all back. They gave the gold's still sitting at 12 something, and they've given it all back. Gold's up fourfold. What is that? More than fourfold. And the mining companies are up zero, right? What a lousy deal that was. They should have some stickiness to that price, and they don't because they can't. They're not making money, right? That's a disappointing thing. I'm not interested in a company like that.
Yeah, anytime you add anything in between the price of the spot commodity and, you know, what you're holding, you're invariably taking on more risk, right?
Right.
You add a management team in there, you add, you know, a balance sheet at a company that needs to be managed. Anytime you can add the element of human error, there's a chance somebody is likely going to fuck it up, even if gold spikes.
Right.
So my question to you is, how do you own it then?
Well, I own quite a bit of physical. I actually bought again around 1200. I had a burst of activity, again losing track, but as gold sort of settled into what a friend called the column zone, because it just kept coming back to 1200. And on Twitter, he'd say, "Hey, what's the price of gold, Dave?" And I'd always say around 1200, and that became the running joke. And as it settled in and it felt like the beatings had subsided, I went and actually doubled my position, and so I might be as high as probably 20. I quote 25%. I think that's 25% of my investable assets are in gold now.
So I don't
most of the rest is cash.
I don't want the code to your secret vault. But when you say you hold physical, I mean, is it local physical, or are you holding overseas physical?
No, it turns out it's in a safe deposit box. I'm well aware of the risk, and I'm watching carefully. And if I get a rumbling, if I get a rumbling of risk of safe, if I hear a bank's confiscating safe deposit boxes, it's out. And if they do a wholesale lockdown, which they're not going to do because we're not on a gold standard anymore, right? So why they wouldn't do that? I always get worried about one of these scams, like in California, when they literally were emptying safe deposit boxes, not inventorying them, auctioning it off, and saying, "Oops, my bad." That was a nasty story. But I've got a couple safe deposit boxes, and I have to, you know, when I pull out the drawer, I have to use my legs, right? Don't want to strain my back. And I own a little bit of stuff like the Central Fund of Canada, which I think is a pretty credible one. I haven't bothered with the other ones, which are probably okay. A little rattled by Tulving going under, right? This was one of the big gold suppliers, and then they screwed their clients and went broke. And I'm going, oh man, you. So a lot of the coinage that I bought off radar too. I should probably shut the hell up. But I had a deal with my coin dealer who every time we got gold, I would just run down and give him cash, and I'd stay below the 10K cut. But then I started to hear about the banks are now supposed to report you if it appears as though you're taking out cash below 10K in multiples to beat the 10K cap.
Right.
They're supposed to report you. So I said, okay, it's getting too dangerous now. I don't want the feds to come in on me. So I bought a bunch using Bill Fleckenstein, a woman, Kathy Hudis, I think, or something like that. And I bought a bunch one year with that, but a lot of the gold came off radar, which I'd pay cash. One day I had about 12,000 in gold coming in, and my coin dealer got robbed at the door, and he calls me, says, "Dave, I got robbed." This guy can't rub two nickels. He's broke. He's dead broke, right? So I immediately know it's gone. Right, it's gone. So I said, okay, no problem. I get it. You know, and he had some other people's money left. I said, worry about that. Don't worry about me. I'll be fine. And then he called me later, and I said, how are you doing? Because I know he'd borrowed money to keep his business going and stuff. And he says, I'm just pacing around the apartment. And about 3 days later, they found him dead behind his house. And I'm sitting there going, you know, I'm so fucking lucky that I said, don't worry about me. Because if I had said, you owe me that money.
Right. You would have been.
I'd feel real bad. Right. So my wife had a count. I said, look, my coin dealer's dead. We got off easy. I think his wife did it. I think his wife set him up. She was leaving him. So in any event, but that's the guy. For about 15 years, I'd buy all the gold coins that came into his shop.
It's interesting. I don't want to juxtapose what you just said with something else, but I'm gonna anyways. You know, just as that situation got very serious very quickly, I feel like, you know, if you're looking at things from an Austrian perspective, or you're, you know, as Josh Brown said the other day, perma bears are ridiculous people. I don't know if you saw his post that he gets douchey sometimes.
Sometimes I chat with Josh, it's okay, and other times he goes full douchebag on me, and he's unpredictable.
If you're a skeptic of the system, I think one of the ties that binds, you know, like-minded people is that shit gets serious and you don't notice until after the fact. And this kind of laissez-faire, kind of, you know, cavalier attitude that everything's fine now, and specific to what Josh posted. And by the way, I asked Josh if he would come on the podcast to talk about what he wrote, and he declined.
I'm shocked. This is my shock face.
Yeah. But that attitude, how do people not understand that that's just, it doesn't appear to be arrogance now, right? But after the fact, when everybody's pointing the fingers, whether it's a market collapse, whether it's a small credit cycle burst, or a real estate, you know, cycle disaster, or a full-on currency collapse, or whatever, everybody's standing around pointing at each other. I mean, why is it, Dave, that people are just so unable to understand that that type of attitude now just, it's a fool's errand?
Well, right now, it's because the market's been on a 10-year roid rage, and so If based on the trolling that I get on Twitter from people, I'll post something that has nothing to do with investing, and then they'll say, oh, how are those gold investments you've been pumping, right? And I go, what the fuck is that all about? That's just a non sequitur, you douche. We're trying to have a conversation here, right? So the troll count is starting to get up high enough that I'm thinking it's about time for those guys to get butt fucked.
Well, and you know what? It's just, every time you read something like that, I mean, when I see that headline come across, his feed or any other similar headline put out by financial media or commentators or whatever. You got guys like Ross Gerber out there, you know, defending his purchases.
Oh, Ross Gerber. Oh, my God, though. You're wasting eyeball time reading Ross Gerber. Holy shit.
He's a product of the last 11 years, though, Dave. Just as...
No, he is. No, and he's like a douche. I mean, he's out there just doing the... For those who don't know this, which your listeners all do, but he's out there doing this Tesla pump. Right? He's doing his fist pumping on Tesla. Tesla's going to be a widow maker. There's no fucking way Tesla's going to make anyone money in the long term. That guy's not going to go anywhere. And when the big automakers get serious, they're going to mow his ass down.
So here's what I want to know as it relates to that with you. The first question I have is when you started your investing in WorldCom, right? What was your sophistication level in terms of finances? Okay, so how was the mold?
You
want
to know how zero it is? Right. I didn't know which index to look shit up on. That's how zero was. Because you know, as a kid, I was really sophisticated for a kid. We used to have these great discussions, but then I just went silent. I did chemistry 24/7 until the early 90s, and I started getting serious. But then the intellectual part of investing kicked in, and then once you go bearish, it gets really interesting. Because then you start scorching people with flamethrowers, right? Then you're no longer just investing. Now you're out there. Now you're out there building intellectual cases to try to understand the system, and I love the complexity of the system. And I'm a natural contrarian, which doesn't mean I'm right, but it means I'm comfortable being in the minority and saying, oh, fuck you, I don't care, right? And it doesn't scare me. And part of that's my chemistry training, because the field I'm in is really complicated. Everyone told me I was going to get totally humped going into it. People said you won't understand it. They said you won't get funded. Well, I just put 21 federal grants in a row up, successful fundings, 21 in a row. Any chemist listening to this knows what the fuck that means. That's like winning the lotto. And I just got a 5-year renewal. You know what that is? I'm 64. Gets me to 69. You know what a 5-year renewal on a grant is? The Wall Street guys have a term for it. That's fuck you money. because now I'm funded till I'm 69 years old. And I plan on retiring at 70. And so now I can get out there and I can claim shit and not worry about someone cutting off my funding because they think I'm a douchebag.
That's nice freedom to have, isn't it?
Right. Right.
So what I want to know, what I was trying to get at with that question, though, is like what chiseled away at you to turn you into a bear, right? Going into something like WorldCom and getting these incredible returns, I mean, your natural inclination would be, holy shit, you know, like Gerber and all these guys, throw a dart and fucking I'm going to get rich, and that's it. So was it WorldCom's kind of implosion that started to chisel away and make you a bear?
No, I was already WorldCom didn't implode for a long time after that. I sold it like 50. It got to 60. That was the peak. So I was unbelievably lucky. It was pure luck. And the fact that I didn't know what I was doing, when you pick a lotto ticket and you win, you're not smart. There's nothing smart about that, right? So there was no intellectual skill. Maybe I was smart enough to listen to this guy, recognizing he was ushering information around. Maybe that was smart. But no, I didn't know anything. And so I was a clueless bull. And then what happened is I started reading about ideas of valuation and stuff like that. And but what got me started really was Y2K. And people laugh and go, oh, Y2K, you know, just like the gold bugs are a bunch of fucking idiots. Y2K, there were some very serious players who were scared to death of Y2K. It didn't play out. It was wrong. I had techies tell me, oh, yeah, it did. We fixed. I said, bullshit. If it was as bad as people were saying it could be, it wasn't going to get fixed comfortably. There were going to be mishaps and fuck-ups, and nothing happened. It was a non-starter. But I don't think the risk was zero. I think the risk was real, and it didn't happen, so the asteroid didn't hit. But when it was over, I go, you know what? This market is still totally fucked up. And the nice thing about Y2K is the year 2000, you say, okay, now it's over. There's a deadline. It's not like the current bubble where you go, there's no deadline.
Right.
But I got to the deadline, got past it, and said, I'm not touching these markets. These things are nuts. And I had to ride them for a little while longer, but then finally a tank. I sat in a room with friends at Pfizer and the Nasdaq was sitting at 5,000 at the time, and I said it's going to go triple digits before this is over, and they laughed at me like I was nuts. Got down to 1,100. I'm calling that a win. And then, of course, they rally it back, and you got central bankers. So now to be an investor, you have to worry about what central bankers are doing. That's stupid. We shouldn't be in this wretched situation. We shouldn't be having to guess what Bernanke or Greenspan or Yellen or now Jay Powell. These guys are fucking up the system. And the normal investor is just not equipped to handle what they're doing. So
I don't even I don't even think they're equipped to handle what
they're
doing.
Not at all.
I don't think they have a fucking clue.
So Powell was the great white hope, right? You remember, let's go right into this one. So in December 24th, you get Mnuchin, who the markets tank, 16%?
Yeah.
Off of a 300% run, right?
Right.
This is a flicker. And Mnuchin says he's calling together the president's working group on capital, right? The fucking plunge protection team. And everyone goes, what?
Right.
So is he really afraid of a 16% correction? Now, under the surface, I think there was the leveraged loan market was cracking. But I don't care, right? You got to have bigger balls than that if you're in a position of power like that. And so then what happens a couple days later, Powell gets caught up on stage with Yellen and Bernanke, which he couldn't – well, I'd like to be up there because I'd beat on him. But he shouldn't have been there. The stupidity was finding himself on stage babbling extemporaneously with those two other clowns. And what happens is he mutters something about supporting the markets.
Yep.
And then we get the roid rage. And what he did was he went from being the great white hope to being a weak Fed chair at that instant. So the Powell put was born. Powell was shown to be a weak, weak Fed chair. And now the market's ripping forward because they're not afraid of him, and he's going to have to do he's going to look bad in the future.
And, you know, Mnuchin is also weak, right? I mean, it was just such a dickless move to come out, on December 24th and say, oh, well, the banks have assured me there's ample liquidity. It's like, motherfucker, nobody even mentioned that. What are you talking about? Like, the only person in the room panicking is you.
Right, exactly. But when Powell says he's going to support the markets, holy shit. And, you know, the Fed is making it up as they go. They say they're data dependent. They're not. They're making shit up as they go.
Yep.
And, you know, and they got their 2% inflation target, which is a fabricated number. It's an illegal number. You know, so many people don't know that. The 78 Humphrey Hawkins legislation said the target is zero. It's not two, it's zero. And inflation's been over 2% for 22 months in a row, according to Bookvar. And so these guys are completely fucking it up.
And
it drives me nuts.
The worst part is it's not just the central bankers that don't understand it. It's the mom and pop investor. It's the everyday person that thinks that they're doing the right thing by saving. You know, like somebody like me that was raised in a household where saving was the norm, right? Don't take on debt, maintain a good personal balance sheet. And so the person that thinks that they're doing the right thing is actually in the midst of this system doing the wrong thing because of how fucked everything is right now.
Yeah, but I keep hearing stats saying that mom and pop is exiting the market while you know, who's the buyer? They say the corporate sharebacks are the buyer. I get all tangled up in share buybacks. I'm not a particular fan of those. But so the market for 10 years has looked like a pump and dump scheme.
Right.
Because there is no good story. The GDP grew 30%. The market goes up 300. Excuse me. That makes no sense. The market should track the GDP. And so it's this huge, huge bubble, right? The everything bubble, as Felder likes to say. And the storyline is not a cool tech storyline. What's cool tech? Facebook? It's Stalinist crap, right? The storyline is that the central banks won't let it drop, right? What a dumb. You know how stupid that's going to look when people get their asses kicked? They're going to go, oh, but I was told the Fed would never let the markets drop like they've ever done that before, right?
And it's inevitable. And the worst part is they think that they can prevent it. They think you know, until the question comes up with no answer. Like, I was just talking to my friend Kenny Pulcari a couple weeks ago. Very nice guy, you know, has been in the market for four decades, is a really iconoclast when it comes to the New York Stock Exchange. You know, and he says, oh, I think the rates will normalize in, you know, 7 or 8 years. I think it'll take it a little bit more time. And I'm like, why? First off, you know, I think when he was talking normalization, he was talking 4%, 5%. But how is that going to happen? You know, he didn't know. He couldn't answer. And I don't think the Fed has an answer.
They don't have a clue.
There's no way for rates to go from where they are now to 4% or 5% without there being a fucking problem, a serious problem.
Well, so here's a problem. You know, this is staggering to me. It turns out 14% of the S&P are zombies, right? You go 14%, that's not a huge – of the 500 biggest companies in the world, 14%, what does that come down to? That's like 70 companies in the S&P 500 are zombies. Their cash flow cannot pay the interest on their loans, and their loans are dirt cheap loans. Their interest rates are at these unbelievably stupid Fed-sponsored levels. They crank the rates to 4 or 5%. That zombie count is going to go from 14 to who knows. And the 14 are going to be insolvent.
Oh, beyond insolvent. And it's not just it's not just going to be corporations, Dave. It's going to be
pensions,
individual consumers.
Else.
It's going to be pensions. It's going to be municipalities. It's going to be the country.
Right. Drives me nuts. And, you know, and somehow these clowns at the Fed, they somehow think they're in charge of setting the price. Where did they get this from? What Econ 101 course ever taught that? That's nuts.
I feel like, Dave, you know, the way that I looked at this, and I don't have a traditional economics background, right? And I actually feel like that's something that has worked to my advantage in the way that I've kind of developed my outlook on monetary policy, on the markets, whatever. I wasn't cranked out of a university economics program, just as you weren't. The way that I look at this, and I'd be interested, you know, I'd be interested on your take in the sense that from the limited amount that I know about organic chemistry and many other sciences, is that generally, like mathematics, for instance, there are very finite answers, and there's laws that kind of govern what we know about these things. And it used to kind of be that way with economics, right? When you talk about Econ 101, right, we're not talking about some obscure, you know, me and you are sitting around writing fucking equations on the wall right now. We're talking about supply and demand, right? We're talking about the very, very basics, price discovery, you know, a sound currency. The things that kind of used to, if you were to grow an economy in a terrarium as a pet, you know, the nascent kind of thing that you would kindle as an economy, the very, very, very basics. And then I've always seen it as, you know, for the best interest of politicians and individuals and, you know, just greedy fucks in general, whether it's the banks, whether it's the Fed, whatever, that we have twisted and contorted and put all of these amendments and appendages and rules on this very simple, very delicate set of economic laws so that they could work in our favor to keep, you know, basically to keep people comfortable, to keep people from, you know, not even austerity, but just discomfort. Do you think as a chemist, you know, maybe coming from a background where the answers are very finite and there's no room for kind of fuckery, you think that's kind of helped your perspective when you look at the economy, when you look at monetary policy, to be able to see like, hey, you know, we're taking the basics here and we're just fucking with them. And that's a moral hazard and it's a fool's errand that'll eventually lead to catastrophe. It has to.
Well, so as a chemist, you learn a couple things. I think my physical science does influence it. One thing you learn is that even in a fairly tight science, I'm amazed at what physicists can do. Those guys are extraordinary when they predict stuff and when they can aim a rocket somewhere and it actually gets there, right? That's stunning stuff that they can do. And they saw a black hole, you know, and they're so smart they thought of black holes, right? That's unbelievable stuff. Chemistry's sloppier than that. And biology is even more sloppy, although it's getting much, much better. But as a chemist, what you learn is that, so again, the field I went into, I kept finding out over and over and over that what I was told was true was not true. And a lot of times it wasn't even just wrong, but the question wasn't even correctly asked. It was just that stupid. And it was only because no one had sat down and sort of ground their way through the detailed hard work. And then you say, oh, look at this. We were told this, and it's just not true. So economics being so much more complicated. And, you know, in my research, I deal with feedback loops and systems that feed back on themselves and that changes the outcome and stuff like that. And these are relatively simple. The economy's filled with those. It's like the climate change battle. And no one is good enough to understand those, and they're chaotic systems too. They're systems that you can't understand if they're really truly chaotic systems. And so what economists used to do and what ecologists used to do is they used to study the economy and the ecology of the world, and they would try to describe it. And then somewhere along the way, these guys decide, no, our job is not just to study and understand it, it's to control it. And that's where they get into trouble. And so the economists think they're in charge of controlling the economy, when the best solution is to let the thing just keep adjusting and let it keep adjusting, right? Let Darwinian selection pressures, you know, Hayekian selection pressures kick in.
Right.
And when the thing gets out of equilibrium, it'll jiggle its way back towards equilibrium,
right,
through it, oscillate around it, and then it's never very dangerous. The second thing anyone will tell you is a system that is pushed a mile from equilibrium, a system that's really serious displaced from equilibrium, when it returns with incredible violence. And so whether it's an avalanche that the snow's built up for a long time, or an earthquake in California where nothing's happened for a century and then boom, it lets go, or a volcano or whatever, these are all systems in which the potential energy's been built up and waiting to go. And in a laboratory, when you get far from equilibrium, you get laboratory explosions and fires and stuff like that. And so that the idea that the Fed should somehow preclude pain and suffering as part of the adjustment process, they're just going to produce this unbelievable cataclysmic projectile vomit at some point. It's all going to come in at once. And the metaphor I keep using over and over and over was Richard Russell, the Dow theory guy, right? He said, when he was asked, you know, why can't this go on forever? Why can't they just keep doing this? He says, go into your kid's room and start stacking blocks.
Mm-hmm.
And just keep stacking them. What happens? And you end up with a stack that is so top heavy, it's so vibration sensitive, it is so incapable that the slightest vibration somewhere in the house will cause it to fall. And then you end up with a pile of rubble. And that's what they do when they push the thing away from equilibrium. And they're doing that constantly. They're constantly saying, this gaggle of idiots who are called the Fed or central bankers, they think our job is to take the price of capital, the price of stuff that the market is trying to set, and move it because
right,
we don't agree. What a bunch of boobs. Right? What a bunch of boobs. Here's what the market right now wants. You know what the market wants? It wants deflation. The market wants deflation. The market wants to unwind some of this leverage. It's screaming at us to unwind leverage. I didn't used to be a deflationist. And the Fed saying, oh, no, you don't. Who do you think is going to win that?
Right. And it's just fascinating how people even talk about deflation. You know, deflation used to be a reward for capitalism, right? And now it's,
right,
you know, now it's looked at as like the fucking boogeyman, you know, because,
right,
because prices going down is such a travesty for consumers, right? It's such an absolute travesty. But the interesting thing is, you talk about feedback loops, right? You're talking about kind of this great example of building blocks and the shit just gets too top heavy. As this is happening, Dave, as we could, because if you remember, right, like when QE started, it was like, hey, you know, we're going to do this once because, you know, things are just fucked beyond repair and we're going to engineer a soft landing here because we have to. And then as time...
Or because they caused the problem.
Well, they certainly did. And then as,
right,
then as time progresses, the threshold for the bank to get involved has decreased further and further and further to now, you know, bring us to present nearly with this example we brought up of Steve Mnuchin shitting his pants on a 16% market correction. But as that threshold grows shorter and shorter for intervention, right? Now we can't even have a correction, Dave. We can't even have a pullback. We can't even
have... This is a big, fat, 1,500-pound guy who's got to go on a diet, but he's going to have organ failure.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what it is. His blood's going to go so fucking toxic because of all the debris that he can't go on a diet. They tell, oh, you got to do medically supervised. The Fed's trying to do a medically supervised diet for the economy, and I'm going, the guy's going to blow out his liver before you get him down below 1,200 pounds because his blood's going to be a cesspool.
I always put up that picture of Mr. Creosote from the Meaning of Life, Monty Python's Meaning of Life, when he's in the restaurant just fucking eating and eating and eating. I don't know if you've watched
it. And then he blows up?
Yeah. But I always post that when I talk about, you know, when they talk about the Fed printing more money, because that's exactly what we're doing. But listen to this, man. The worst part, in my opinion, and I'd love your thoughts on this, is as this is happening, as that threshold is being roped in, inadvertently at the same time, people that are not intimate with the financial system, your mom and pop investor, your retail investor, even these, you know, junior wealth advisors and junior brokers and interns and people that are getting churned out of academic institutions, especially nowadays, because the kids that are coming out of college now, you know, they've never even seen a bear market, right? These
right.
people are being conditioned now to expect that what is happening now and what has happened over the last 10 years and this, you know, fucking circus that Mnuchin had in December, that that's the norm.
Yeah, I know. They're told the 2%. And then you get the idiots who write the newspapers and the headlines for Bloomberg and stuff, and they say, you know, inflation's a real problem. And you think, yeah, of course it is. And then they go, because it's not high enough. And I'm going, my God, what kind of morons are running this operation? Right? Oh, yeah, I want more inflation. That's really great because I don't like saving my money. I want to have to spend it on my heating bills and on my taxes and stuff because, oh, there's nothing better than have to spend more on food and more on cars and more on all this crap. What kind of idiot thinks that way? Right? And what they want is they want asset inflation because they're hoping
right.
somehow – pumped, you know, by pumping the perception of wealth up, they're somehow going to make us richer, right? Maybe that fat guy ought to get on a scale that says he weighs 280 and just declare victory, right? That's a good idea.
Well, and also, too, when you think about, you know, you brought up pensions before, right? So what are pension funds doing now to absolve, to attempt to absolve their liabilities? They're fucking issuing bonds. All right.
And buying equities
in the hopes that the equity markets are going to, you know, that it's going to be some type of carry trade.
Oh,
where...
and they're also going into private equity, which is a real goddamn snake pit, because that's where those guys are nuts. Those are the 20-somethings.
I brought up to Peter Schiff when he was on. He was arguing with some liberal on MSNBC years ago, but he says, you know, they're talking about the debt ceiling, and he says the way to pay off debt is not to go further into debt. And the woman debating him is like, well, that's just fundamentally not true. It's like, hey, that's what we're fucking dealing with right now.
Yeah, I know. You know, I say I love quotes. I just love quotes because first of all, they have a lot of action in them. You get the right quote, there's a huge amount of information, and someone else did the real intellectual scholarship. You just steal it. And oh my God, I've got so many quotes from people who are, they're just going to eat it so badly when this goes to hell. And so here's the question is, what would prove me wrong? And what will prove me wrong is that in the next recession, and you know, if there are people listening and you think there's not going to be another recession, get professional help. You have an unstable personality. In the next recession, whenever it is, and I'm praying it's sooner rather than later because I'm getting tired of this. If it's a generic recession and everything just kind of blows out and then we're back in the saddle again and there's no catastrophe, then my worldview is just wrong. It's just that simple because right now we've got most of the public pensions are funded to about 70% in the middle of a raging bull market. And so what's going to happen? So, you know, crude estimates the market ought to correct at least 50%. By my math, the market ought to correct 50% to get to a normal level.
Right.
If it regresses through the mean, if the 50% correction damages stuff, right, what are the odds of that, right? That's like if we have an explosion, but it only blows half the house off, right? And if we correct 50%, if it's in conjunction with a bond market bear, right? The bond market's been in a 38-year bull market. If the bonds turn, then the stocks are going to turn by definition, I think. And so then all of a sudden you got your stocks, your bonds going down simultaneously. Pension funds are going to go from 70% funded to 35% funded. What happens? I don't have an answer to that.
Well, nobody does. People think that they do. But I just want to just go back to what you just said, though. I mean, you just made a great and very simple point to open up what you just said, which is if the pension funds are only covered to a degree of 70%, and you read these articles now, most Americans don't have $500 in a savings account and shit like that. When you look at corporate balance sheets, when you look at personal balance sheets, when you look at the country's balance sheet, when you look at these pension liabilities, when these things are at the levels that they're at now, after 11 years, Dave, of quote-unquote prosperity.
Right.
I mean, how do people not see that as a giant canary in the coal mine? We're supposed to be living the fucking high life right now. This country is supposed to be, if you watch TV, you watch the financial news, this country is supposed to be at the top of the mountain now, at this great position of wealth. And it just isn't there.
Right. And the politics say that socialism is coming. Right, this 65% public support for socialism is a staggering thing. I mean, that's like I'd support pedophilia before socialism, for Christ's sakes, right? Actually, I wouldn't. For the record out there, you douchebags who can't take a joke, get over it. But the fact of the matter, socialism is the stupidest goddamn thing. But now they're calling it democratic socialism. They're trying to whitewash it. You got idiots like AOC and idiots like this Omar, what's her face, and they're all idiots, right? And here's one for your readers. I'm listening to Tucker Carlson's book, Ship of Fools. Now, Tucker, I used to think, was a total boob, and I just love the guy now. And what you ought to do is get his audiobook, because he reads it himself, and it's like 4 or 5 hours of him just raging against this craziness. And he's right-leaning, but he is hammering everyone, and he does it with that Tucker Carlson skate. I mean, he's just slicing and dicing them like some Ronco device, right? And so it's so entertaining. It's just so phenomenally entertaining, the book. I want to keep stopping it and recording quotes on my phone and stuff because he's so good. He's so good.
You remember Ronco? You remember Ron Popeil?
Oh yeah, change the dial from slice to dice.
Yeah, man. I mean, just the fact that you can just come out with that now means that guy fucking did it right. Regardless of the piles of shit that he was selling and the spray paint he was putting in his fucking hair. Oh, he crushed it.
Ron Popeil, I think.
Ron Popeil, yep. Yeah.
Yeah, right. He made a fortune selling shit.
And there was something so hypnotic about those infomercials, too. Like, you'd watch that fucking dude slice a tomato, and it would just look so effortless. That when the damn thing was on again, you couldn't help but watch,
Yeah, yeah, like I've ever sliced a tomato.
Let's go back on the socialism thing real quick. And I want to tie that to, your joke that you made, which you immediately backed off on, because now...
Well, I had to back off because someone will quote me on it. You know that thing about loving quotes? Well, I just gave them one, and I...
there's going to be no context.
I'm not afraid.
I want to, in doing research for this podcast, I went back and I was looking up a couple of your television appearances, which, by the way, and please forgive me, but I didn't know that you were so widely covered as you were. And I watched your RT interview. I listened to a couple of their podcasts that you've done. I honestly found this stuff fascinating. One of the things that I touched on that I started to read, but I just figured, I'm just going to ask him tomorrow, was some type of controversy at Cornell because of something that you said or did that was probably taken out of context or whatever. And I wanted to know if you would just tell us the story, because I think...
Okay. Go ahead. I got to be careful here because...
No, you don't.
I mean, there's a metaphor I'll give you. So Cornell came and tried to unionize... The UAW tried to unionize about a dozen years ago, and the UAW came. And we've got an industrial and labor relations school, which is like a standing army for unionization. It is really a union stronghold. And so I helped set up an anti-union group, and they had open forums, and the ideas went out, and there was an 89% turnout rate for voting, and they voted it down 2-1. And that was a big victory. I was getting emails from people saying, great job, because I was sort of semi-front and center. So then the American Federation of Teachers shows up. About 3 or 4 years ago, and it's a multi-million-dollar unionization campaign. This is big stakes because if you add it up, it turns out Cornell would be contributing dues, a couple of million dollars a year worth of dues if they can unionize the grad students. So this is an annuity. Every goddamn school they unionize the grad students is a multi-million-dollar annuity for the union. So it's just great stuff for them. So they put in all the money, and they play it brilliantly. And what they do is they refuse to do open forums. And so I contact the provost and say, we got to do something. And so again, I set up another anti-union group. I'm probably not even supposed to fess up to that. But what a shock. One of my grad students was on it. What are the odds of that? And as before, same thing. And so the anti-union group stayed arm's reach from me. And then we were going to lose big. And there's no question, right? You got the social justice crap going on campus and stuff. And we were going to lose big because the sentiment had changed. And so I sent it. And I actually talked to Cornell Legal, and I said, I'm going to fight him. I'm going to fight the union. And if you don't mind, if these guys aren't filing charges against me at the NLRB repeatedly, I'm going to be disappointed. And Cornell counsel said, that's okay. So in any event, so I sent out an email to about 250 people on a listserv that I had and saying, we got to get the vote out. This is the faculty. And I got nothing, no interest, nothing. And I said, we're about to go union. And once you go union, you don't go back. And if you look, to make a long story short, unionizing grad students is a bad idea. I could give you an hour and a half on that alone. It's just a bad idea because they're not homogeneous. And so I throw this email out, they file charges, and then I defend myself, and there's no problem. But I get no bites. And then we're about to lose big, and I send out another email. I said, shake the buildings out. Get the students at any cost. Get them voting. Get them out. I got emphatic. And they filed another charge against me. But they made one fundamental mistake. Someone posted my email on social media. And that got the ideas out there. So then what happened, the Cornell Daily Sun newspaper wanted to do a hit piece on me. And so they called me one night. I don't do interviews. I do podcasts, but I won't do interviews because interviews will parse out phrases
right.
And hammer you. Whereas you and I, you know, someone can listen to the whole podcast and say, okay, he's nuts. He's not. This is what he meant. Who cares, right? And I said, I did an interview for you guys, and you didn't publish it. And they go, well, we want to talk to you now about this email you sent. I said, okay. I had to call an audible, and they asked me a bunch of questions, and they wrote a hit piece on me the next day. At the end of the interview, I said, it looks like it's kind of done. And I said to the woman, I said, I'm not done. And she says, oh, what else you want to say? And I go, no, that's a quotable quote. I'm not done. And so she goes, oh, so I knew she took the bait. And so at the end of the hit piece, she writes at the bottom, she says, and column says, I'm not done. And so here I am. And so then the Cornell Review, which was started by Ann Coulter for the record, I did an interview for them. It was very carefully done. And so the idea, normally they get 50 clicks on a campus. They got thousands. And so I got the real sort of careful, it was done by email, so we went back and forth, so it was well done, and that got out there. And then we got to the day in the vote, and out of 2,000 kids voting, they lost by 60 fucking votes. And so I know there were hundreds and hundreds of votes that were swung because they blew it.
Right.
And the NLRB never ruled against me. They always said, no, you didn't send it to a grad student, you're fine. You didn't threaten any grad students, you're fine. And so we won by 60 votes. So, okay, so it's over. And it's like 3 or 4 weeks later, and I'm a civilian again, and all of a sudden this hit piece comes out in the Cornell Daily Sun. And you know my Twitter feed. It's filled with all sorts of crap, including irreverent jokes. They're not awful. My dean follows me. Cornell follows me. I'm aware of this. But they went back through my Twitter feed over years and dug up some shit. And then they quoted it out of context. They went through my year in review and dug up some shit, and they quoted it out of context. And I thought they got me. I thought they really got me. And I got a call from a lawyer colleague over in the law school, and he said, "You see the article?" I said, "Yeah, I couldn't even read it. I couldn't stand reading it." And he said, "Yeah, you got a lawyer up." And so I got some help from this group that helps people lawyer up against douchebags on campuses. And then he calls me, and that was Friday. He calls me on Saturday. He says, "If you don't mind, I'm going to write a counterattack." I said, "Have a ball, right? Cornell law professor, that's fantastic."
That's what I read, yeah.
He ripped the asshole out of them like you wouldn't believe. And by the end, I think they were lawyering up, and I have a little bit of evidence they were panicking. And anyway, he took them to the cleaners. And then I knew it was coming, and so I read it quick, and then I wrote an email to my department that was carefully laid out and also had some more attack on him. I said, "Fuck it, I'm going at him again too." And I sent to my department, and then I had one of my colleagues. I said, "Would you do me a favor? Post this in the comments section of the article of the lawyer's counterattack." He said, "You want your email to the department posted?" And I said, "Oh yeah, that's what I wrote it for." So he posted it in there. So then this is a guy who runs the legal insurrection Twitter feed and college insurrection, a guy named Bill Jacobson. So next thing he knows, he's on Mark Levin show and Lars Larson show, and he's getting interviewed, and the Federalist and all the fucking conservative papers are all talking about conservative Cornell professor attacked for opposing unionization. And my colleagues come in, and they go, "You okay?" And I said, "I'm a pig in shit now. This is fun. I'm having a ball now. I'm watching these guys get their asses kicked." And so that was a lot of fun at the end. There was a painful low point there, but in the end. And so then I got this funny email that said, "I'm a friend of the people, and I want to disown them because of what they did, but I don't know what to do. What do you think I should do?" And I'm reading this email, and I'm thinking, this fucker's trying to figure out what I'm thinking.
Right, yep.
He's trying to get me to say something, pretend like he's my friend, and he's not. So I pretended to believe him. I said, "No, they made bad judgments. You shouldn't disown them, blah, 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 blah." And what I said is, I said, "What they didn't know is you can't throw a punch without getting punched back." And then I finished by saying, "What they also didn't know is that if they had damaged me, which they did a little, but nothing awful, but if they'd really hurt me, my defense would have been to destroy them, and I can assure you I would have destroyed them." And I said, "That's the important message that they probably never got in their upbringing, is that I would have destroyed them." And I knew that he'd take that back to them. And so if they come back at me, they're gonna get bitch slapped like there is no tomorrow.
How long ago was this?
This was probably 3 years ago.
Okay, so this is like right around the time that the fucking like Jordan Peterson thing happened too, right?
I mean, well, maybe 4 or 5 years ago. I think it was a little before it, but I certainly didn't know who Jordan was at the time. I did not know Jordan at the time, but his stuff could have been starting. Jordan's huge compared to me. I'm just a mosquito in this world. But then I keep finding myself in the middle of this shit. And so, you know, when Peter Boghossian was at risk of getting fired for publishing those grievance study papers that were a hoax, and I sort of helped try to lead the campaign to make sure that Portland State didn't fire him. And he hasn't been fired yet, so at some level we won. And then, you know, Zero Hedge was going to get knocked off Facebook, and I went on a rampage on that and tried to rally the troops. And when they they finally wrote an article about getting reinstated. I got some press out of that one. I was glad because I worked my ass off to try to beat the Bushes to undo that injustice. And so every once in a while, I just see a cause that just needs someone to pound, and I do it.
I think it's so important now because, look, when I was in my early 20s, all right, I was a, full on liberal, right? Like as liberals existed then, right? I wasn't a libertarian. I wasn't I was anti-GOP. I didn't really understand politics very well as it happens. But the way that things have gone now, and I eventually, I think, it was the first time Ron Paul ran for president. I think it was 2004 of recent. I think he ran years prior to that, but I think it was like 2004 I started listening.
2008 was the big year where he was making some real headway, in my opinion.
Right, but I think it was...
I was an endorser on his homepage of his website. Right on the homepage, I was actually an endorser.
It wasn't until I heard him...
That was a proud moment.
Yeah, it wasn't until I heard him and saw that he had the voting record to back up what he was saying and...
Oh, he's a great guy.
Went back
I got to have dinner with him. He was such a sweet, sweet guy.
He seems
so humble.
He seems like a very gentle and,
absolutely.
Does what he says, Dave, and says what he does, which just doesn't exist in a world full of fucking, all of
liars.
These... Exactly. And that was what drew me to him. And that was eventually kind of what turned me on to... libertarian style thinking, but the point I'm trying to make is with the way that things have gone here over the last 10 years, and as somebody that, again, I don't know how you identify politically, if you do at all, but...
Well, I come from the right, but I'm disgusted by the right as well.
Right.
But I certainly have, if you listen to my views, they're right wing. So, libertarianism is where right and left meet, right? There's two interfaces, and one's the moderates, and the other's the libertarians. And the libertarians basically agree that the government's bad, and the
right.
left tend to think they're bad because they're evil empire, and the right thinks they're bad because they're too big.
I just feel like over the last 10 years, the left has, the gate has swung so far to the left with, and look, I stand for equality. I stand for all of the social issues that liberals today stand for. I can get behind, and it's easy to get behind them as a libertarian. Oh, fuck. There goes the phone. Sorry. It's a real Mickey Mouse operation I got here. You still with me?
Yeah, I'm with you.
Okay, perfect. Sorry. it's a circus here, Dave. All of these, liberal kind of social issues, I can get behind many of them. It's easy to as a libertarian because, really, you want people to live however they want to live and be happy without infringing upon the rights of other people. But this
right.
kind of proactive assault on people that do not think like-minded has swung...
Well, it started when Hillary lost, right? I mean, it really... Just it was a quantum leap when Hillary lost. So the left thought that the left is I think on average they tend to be more educated, which doesn't mean that they're smarter, but they're more educated, and they always think they have the moral high ground. I think they're right, even though
always.
Sometimes they don't. I think they even know they're rubbing the system a little bit, but historically, right? But something happened. Carlson gets all over this too, and it's really good. He says he sort of asks the question, when did the left become a bunch of war hawks, for example, right? At one point, the left opposed war, right? You don't bomb countries. They always opposed war,
right?
And now the left wants to bomb the shit out of everyone because something's wrong down there. And where, you elect a liberal president. I didn't have anything against Obama. I thought there was something uplifting about an articulate black man who's now president, who can give a speech in coherent sentences, unlike Bush. And I'm thinking, this isn't going to be bad. And then he bombs the shit out of seven Muslim countries. We're not supposed to bomb people. We're just not. I'm a Reagan Republican, but we're not supposed to bomb people, right? That's a war crime. That's a fucking war crime. And we're doing it, and we're bombing Syria because we don't like the guy in charge. Well, who fucking cares what we don't like? We're talking about bombing Venezuela because we don't like the guy in charge. What the fuck is that about? Who gives us the right to tell Venezuela how screwed up to be? And you want to know how screwed up they are? They're screwed up because of our sanctions. We've put our foot on their throats. They're starving to death in Venezuela because of us. Their socialism didn't help. They wouldn't be starving if we didn't do it. So I just think we're acting awful. And yet that traces back to the collapse of the Cold War, where all of a sudden we didn't have an opposing superpower. And next thing you know, we could go traipsing around the world doing shit because we didn't have to worry about the Ruskies. And now we're picking a fight with Russia. What a stupid move. What a dumb move to pick a fight with Russia. The Russian collusion shit.
It's just the same arrogance with, you know, you're talking about foreign policy. It's the same arrogance that you see with monetary policy. It's this chest puffed out. Like you're saying, well, we're in fucking Syria. Well, we're in Venezuela. You know, it's like, let's worry about us, number one.
And this is, where Trump looked like he was going to be good at.
Well.
So I supported Trump because, A, I like the idea of jamming it up someone's ass. But also I supported it because he seemed like he wasn't going to be militaristic.
Right.
And unfortunately, he's a guy who makes deals, and I think he's making deals. And some of these deals include bombing people, and I don't like them. And generally, I like his up yours approach. There's people who hate him so much, and I just don't quite get it because you know, I don't think he's a racist. I've become a build a wall guy for several reasons. One is because A, you should control your border. And if you want to tell me the wall won't do it, that's fine. But you don't know what you're talking about because no one knows what the fucking wall can do and not do. And then B, that you control your border. And then let's have a serious discussion about what we should be doing with the border. And that's fine. And by the way, Trump got elected to build a wall, so give him his fucking wall. Right? The people want the fucking wall. Give him the fucking wall. It's that simple.
But Dave, that gets conflated, okay? This is how fucking out of whack everything has gotten. When you take a stand against something like illegal immigration, okay, which is immigration with the word illegal in front of it, right? Illegal,
right,
meaning
right.
Fucking against the law, right?
Right.
When you take a stand against...
What part of illegal don't you understand, right?
When you take a stand against something like illegal immigration, you are just lamb-fucking-basted. You're heartless and you're soulless and you want to separate mothers from their children and our ancestors came here and the ancestors before years. Them came here illegally and like go ahead, I'm sorry.
I go nuts. This drives me crazy. So I support the wall. It's not a panacea. It's not going to save everything, but put up the wall for Christ's sake. It's like hydrodynamics, right? It's like, you know, if you constrict the pipe, you get less flow. Right?
Yeah.
It's that simple. Well, if you build the wall tall and people say, well, they'll tunnel under it. Not that the illegal immigrants, the drug lords will get under it. Sure.
Right.
Right. Right. But they're not going to be moving, get thousands and thousands of people. And you know, those caravans coming north, I go, holy shit, get the wall up now. Right. If we can't control our borders, it's crazy. And of course, now I'm a fucking racist because I want to build a wall just to control immigrants. I'm not a fucking racist. I just think we ought to build a fucking wall. By the way, if you don't want to build the wall, then take away the TSA guys at the goddamn airport.
Right.
Take away the customs guys at the airport. Just let everyone flow. You know, let's do the reverse of Brexit. Let's just open those borders up and have a ball, right?
It's just fascinating. Because like you're saying, it's like we're just talking about the economy, right? We're talking about very simple Econ 101, and here we are back to very simple physical border control, right? just because the wall is a simple idea, right? Like you're saying, it's like hydrodynamics, right? You put something right in front of the fucking water and it's going to, you know, you constrict the pipe and less is going to get through, right? Just because right? it's a simple idea doesn't mean that it doesn't have any credibility, that doesn't hold any gravitas. It's what we skipped over, you know?
But everything's a political football now. Absolutely everything. And then the media has let us down so profoundly. Both sides. You know, I stopped watching Fox. I don't need guys lying to me about right-wing ideas. I don't need guys lying to me about left-wing ideas. Two people lying to me from the two sides doesn't somehow collide and produce truth. Right? We get our truth from reading the blogs, right? From finding smart guys who no one knows who the hell they are who are putting it all together. But it's so hard now because the media is such, Brian Stelter, there's a loser and a half. The whole CNN crowd, oh my God, what happened to those guys? They used to be bone dry newscasters. Now they become whores and prostitutes and gigolos and pimps and everything else under the sun.
And they're just like, and this will get taken out of context too, okay? But I put up a post the other day that I think I may have taken down, but it just said, you know, when people fight for equality, right, it means equality amongst those that are in the majority too, right? Like, equality doesn't mean that all men should be emasculated and be women and that we should just, you know...
Apparently it does.
Well, equality means equal, right? You want equal footing. You want equal masculinity with equal, you know, femininity. You want equal white with equal, you know, additional ethnicities, right? It doesn't mean you eliminate the majority. It doesn't mean that you eliminate the party and if equality of outcome is a goal, which we could argue on its own. But let's just think about that, right? And now it feels like. It just feels like there is no gusto, that there's no, like, you talk about a guy named, like, Brian Stelter, whatever his name is, and he just seems panicked and upset and, like, whiny and emasculated and, like, you know, you can fight for equality and you can, like you're saying, you make a great point, right? You don't want to be lied to from both sides of the aisle. Just like you,
right.
Just like you don't want, you know, you don't want either side of genders or anything in between to be eliminated. You want everybody to fall where they fall on the spectrum. But that means, you know, you still have to have some people far off in one direction and some people far off in the other direction. When you talk about these newscasters on CNN, especially on MSNBC, I mean, which is, I think, arguably right. more liberal than CNN. They are, and also, to your credit, Fox News, too, which has an agenda, right? They are, the people on CNN and MSNBC were visibly upset and shaken with, for instance, this, you know, on election night, but also with this Russian collusion thing, too. I mean, it was just painted on them that they could not, and it's just, what happened? What the hell happened to these people, Dave? Seriously.
They lost their shit. I don't know. There were 500,000 articles written about Russian collusion, according to some intrepid Google searcher. 500,000 articles written about it, and the whole thing turns out to be a pretty big nothing burger. I'm sure that if we read that 450-page report with all the redactions and crap in it, you would find some statements. I'm sure you can find some statements that said that so-and-so met with so-and-so. You know, the most amazing thing, this is what bothers me so much, is you know, the blind spot that friends of mine who are so smart, the blind spot they have about the badass people on the left, like the Clintons and their uranium deals and their and heaven only knows how many people got whacked by friends of the Clintons and the kickbacks and the, you know, whatever it is that generated $100 million worth of net worth and somehow they get a pass.
Right.
Somehow they get a pass. You know, when Bill was he could have been a transformational president, but he was getting blowjobs off of an intern, not a metaphorical intern, a person who is called an intern. And I don't know anyone in any major organization who can get blowjobs off an intern and keep their fucking job.
Maybe Musk.
None.
Maybe Musk could get away with it.
Penthouse Magazine. Yeah, then you can get blowjobs off an intern. Right? But he kept his job. That's why he should have been disqualified. It wasn't because I thought he was a bad president. It's that you don't bang interns, period. And then Hillary's just this total, you know, pathetically bad sociopath. Good sociopath, you don't know they're a sociopath. Bill was close to a perfect sociopath. I've read about sociopathy. The Clintons formed an alliance. They are two sociopaths in a pod. And Bill's phenomenal. He's got the charm. He's got all the things that sociopaths have. Hillary was pathetic. You could see right through her sociopathy. But mean. Oh, my God, what an alligator she is. And somehow everyone loves Hillary just because she's a chick, just because she has ovaries. I don't know what the hell it is. So, you know, I could have voted for Elizabeth Warren. You know, I used to chat with her before she was famous. Late at night, we'd swap emails and swap articles and stuff. And I did a couple blogs for her. She's a decent person. And she's super left now. She's taken to politics way too comfortably for my taste. She's way too good at it now. I would like to see more Tulsi Gabbard in her than she's got. But she's a decent person. I don't think Hillary's a decent person yet. Yet everyone said, oh, we have to have Hillary. And I go, pick a better candidate. Pick one. And by the way, not Bernie. He's such a lefty. It's ridiculous.
But what I give Bernie credit for that I don't give credit to Hillary for, and there's a lot about both people that I don't like, is that if I had to choose between the two of them in terms of who comes by their position more honestly,
Bernie, by far.
And just to your point about Elizabeth, Elizabeth Warren, right?
My brother and I are both super right-wingers, and we both agreed that if it was Bernie against Trump, we could have plugged our nose and said, you know, the Donald scares us a little too much. We could have become never-Trumpers. But then I decided no. I decided that the system was robust, and I could never pull the lever for Hillary. She just sets the bar so low that I just couldn't do it. And the decision was whether to vote third party, which I'm a big fan of doing, or to vote for Trump. And I thought his lack of militarism was worthy of my vote. And I'm despondent that he hasn't held as tough on that as I think he wanted to. I think he wanted to. But the Middle East isn't about oil anymore. It's about war. The industrial military complex, that's what the Middle East is about now. Oil doesn't matter. We can get the oil. They'll sell it to us. That's not a problem. The Middle East is about war. It's about Billy Crystal and all his maniacs.
Well, just let me go back real quick to what you were saying, though, about Elizabeth Warren and to what you said prior about Obama, right? Because I share some of those sentiments with you, right? I see people on the right, they fucking hate Obama, right? They absolutely.
I don't see why they'd hate the guy.
They loathe him. And I thought that he was a very well-spoken orator. I did find him to be intelligent. There are things I disagreed with him on, just as I'm saying now that in terms of integrity, you know, I found Sanders to be a far more, you know, believable person, that he believed actually what he was saying. And, you know, Hillary just to me seemed very formulaic. Like, she had the answers prepared in advance, like somebody had put her together in a lab with a petri dish and fucking turkey basters, and that they were going to come up with the right formula for a winning candidate for the Democratic Party. And I think the inflection point, Dave, was that people saw through that, which I think is fascinating.
Well, yeah, and you know, my write-up on the my post-election analysis, I said she made three fundamental mistakes. And one is that she rigged all the polls and then believed them. That was a fundamental mistake. Right. They controlled the polls. You know they were controlling the polls. And then second of all was that fateful faux pas where she said she's going to – instead of saying I'm going to put the coal industry out of business, she said I'm going to put coal miners out of a job. She picked the lowest rung in the socioeconomic ladder and said I'm going to shit on them. And it came off as so tone deaf. And then the last one – and very few people if any, that I know of comment on this, when she called everyone the deplorables.
Right, yeah.
It was not that she called them deplorable. She used a noun. And you could watch her try to fix it. As they defended her, they kept using the verb. They kept saying, referring to people as deplorables, adjective, again, whatever the fuck, who cares. She kept saying, referring to people as deplorable. And what she said was deplorables. And that's dehumanizing. That's turning them into a non-human. That's like Juden. That's giving someone a name, a label that makes them not human. And that's how you vilify them. And that sat so poorly, I think. And so those were big mistakes. The other thing is she got duped in the debates. This is another thing. I don't think anyone else wrote about this. Trump threw the first debate, in my opinion. He had huge amounts of information on Hillary. He knew everything about Hillary. His team had all the dirt. They knew all the shit she was doing. He used none of it in the first debate. He did a rope-a-dope. I even think that he and Megyn Kelly in the primaries set up the fight. I think his people contacted Megyn and said, ask a nasty question, we'll get in a big brawl, you'll get famous, I'll get press.
Yeah, wow.
Rickroll. We're going to rickroll this whole goddamn media. Do it. We'll both win. And I think Megyn said, you got it.
It worked out for her,
but
too,
he gets in the debate.
If
he throws the first debate. Why? Because the first debate didn't matter. So then they declared him a loser. They declared him he's not presidential. It's game over. How many times have they said that? He saved his ammo. He rope-a-doped her. And then he came out and he beat the living snotballs out of her in the second debate. She was absolutely stunned by his withering attack. And he had to defend the goddamn grab the pussy comment in that one. He came out of that debate looking phenomenal.
And he marched in there too with all of the Bill Clinton's accusers. That was the second debate too, right?
Oh yeah.
He rolled them out.
You know how to influence the election? You know what I did? This is great. So Juanita Broderick shows up on Twitter. Her name is @Sunhut on Twitter. And she shows up and puts her name Juanita Broderick. And people say, nah, that's a parody account, blah, blah, blah. And she posted a tweet that said, Bill, you know you raped me. Hillary, you know you tried to destroy me. And people were saying, nah, that's not a real account. And some reporter said, I made some phone calls. That's her. So here's what I did. So I said, Juanita, who's one of my proud followers, I said, Juanita, you know, you can pin that tweet if you want. And she says, I don't know how to pin a tweet. And so I taught her how to pin a tweet. And she pinned that motherfucking tweet that went so goddamn viral. So if you want to help an election, you don't cast one vote. You teach Juanita Broderick how to jam a truck up Hillary Clinton's ass. That's how you help win an election. And I got screen grabs on her saying, thanks, I did it. It's really great. That's and once in a while you get in and go, oh, that was satisfying. Yeah. So when he brought those people and Bill and they were all sitting there and he has his press conference. Oh my God, was that funny. That was hysterical.
It was just every time you thought Trump wasn't going to do something and you say, ah, that might be a little too much. That might be a little too far. You know, is he really going to pivot? Is he really going to pivot on that question in the debate to Bill Clinton, you know, who was obviously and he did it and it fucking worked too. When they said to him, you know, he said, look, I'm not proud of it. It was locker room talk. Okay. But you look at somebody like Bill Clinton. At one point he said, Bill Clinton has said much worse to me on the golf course.
He's getting hit on abortion. And my guess, he's a big fan of abortion. My guess, you know, he's banged so many women through the years. There's no way he's pro-life, right? He can't afford to be pro-life. So he gets pinned on abortion, right? I am a pro-choice atheist with some respect for religion. I've written in support of religion as an atheist, as a pro-choice atheist.
Right.
And so he's in the debate. And when they get to the abortion part, by the time he's done, he's got Hillary pulling fucking third trimester babies out of the womb personally and crushing their skulls. And Hillary just sitting there shell-shocked. And he's like hanging it right on her, and he's like strangling her with umbilical cords as he's describing these abortions in grisly detail. And I'm going, holy shit, he's winning on abortion.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, he went there. Everywhere you thought he wasn't going to go, he went there. He had an answer for everything, whether or not it was planned, whether or not he was shooting from the hip, whether or not he was bullshitting or he was. But like when he said something like the comment I was just talking about, you know, Bill Clinton has said worse to me on the golf course, I immediately knew that was true because you knew that they palled around prior to all this happening. You know what I mean? So like it was such a fascinating angle that he had on everything. And it was just it was the perfect prescription. You know, it was the perfect.
I got to read Art of the Deal. It's on my list. I got to figure out what that book says. I was told that that book explained.
He didn't write it. You know,
I don't know.
I don't think he wrote one word of that book. But you know, anyways, listen, Dave. I want to thank you very much for coming on, and I also want to immediately extend an invitation to have you back at some point very soon. So will you come
back? Talk economics.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, whatever. We'll talk about whatever the fuck we want to talk about, you know?
Right.
But yeah, let's over the next week or two, can we do this again? We set up something else and
anytime,
continue this conversation?
Anytime.
Because I have a list of about 50 questions here that I want to ask you, but I don't want to hold you because you were kind enough to make some scheduling arrangements. But let's catch back up in probably a week or two, and we'll do a part two to this podcast.
Send me a DM.
I will. I will very much. And thank you so much for coming on, Dave. Dave Collin.
You bet.
We'll talk soon.
You bet.
All right. Bye-bye. Thanks again, Dave. Bye-bye.
Yep.